You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and digging deeper into the issues that make and break our lives. And our guest for this hour is Roald Hoffman. So we're going to start, shall we start with a piece of music?
Yes, let's start with a piece of music, because it'll lead into where I come from.
Sure, okie doke, and here we go. Hang on a second here, we're having technical difficulties.
Okay.
And that was Shalom Aleichem. And our guest this morning is Roald Hoffman for this hour of the Made of Clay Report. Welcome, Roald.
Oh, I'm glad to be here, Eric.
It's good to have you. Now, I know that for many people you will not need to be introduced, but at the same time, also many people don't know who you are. So tell me, give me a thumbnail sketch. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Yes, so I'm... by origin, a Polish Jew, and that is an important part of my story. And I'm an immigrant to the United States at age 11. Grew up in New York City then, went to PS 16 Brooklyn, to Stuyvesant High School, to Columbia, to graduate school at Harvard, and then I wound up in Ithaca. And I am a chemist. I'm a theoretical chemist. Maybe I'll tell you more about what that means. And I have been in Ithaca. This is my life, despite many temptations to go elsewhere, mm-hmm. for almost 49 years. Oh. We have a daughter, Ingrid, who is in town with her family, and she was 3 weeks old when we came here. So we look at her and we can see how long we've been here. I also am a writer. Mm-hmm. I write poetry, plays, nonfiction, just about everything except fiction. Mm-hmm. And that's important to me, too. I'm a human being. I'm an Ithacan. Yeah. I'm at Cornell University.
Right, right, right. And do you want to say a little bit about the song?
Yes. So that song has to do with my beginnings. That's a traditional song for greeting the Sabbath. It's sung in most religious Jewish homes. And interestingly, the music was not written until about 100 years ago, though the verses are older.
So the melody could be varied depending upon where you were.
Could be. Before then, it was varied. I think it was part of the reception of the Sabbath. So it's out of the Jewish tradition, mm-hmm. and that's where I come from. It's sung by a woman, and in an Orthodox Jewish home, you would never have it sung by a woman, mm-hmm. because there is some religious conviction that... men should not listen to music sung by a woman. Now, that sounds very strange today. And so that's part of the story. I chose that because it's sung by a woman. Mm-hmm. Because we came, and I'm talking now about my parents back in Poland, is we came out of assimilation, but we also came, so we came out of a certain rebellion against the religious tradition. Mm-hmm. And something we can talk about is how far can you run?
Right.
But we came out of that, and my parents were socialists and Zionists, and that is our tradition. So and the song is, the song means a lot to me. Mm-hmm. The ways of identifying yourself as Jewish around the world have certainly moved very far from the religious roots.
Right, right. But I think to be honest to the experience of people around us, there are times when what they do with earnestness, and there are times when what they do with a certain amount of tongue-in-cheek or sleight of hand, that it's honoring it, but it's also questioning it at the same time. And that's exactly
what
you've
done. And that's part why I played that song, sung by a woman.
And we, if we were more honest, we all do that much of the time.
Yeah. It's a lovely, welcoming song, welcoming the angels of the Sabbath. Yep.
So tell me, how do you want to? What major experiences have most defined your life? You've danced over the geography, and the cultural and political affiliations of those national affiliations. But what were the experiences? What's some of the experiences that have shaped who you are? We could go on for a long time now.
Part of the experiences were that the many languages, the many cultures we went through. After our story of survival, English was my sixth language. Mm-hmm. It's the only language in which I can write now, though I speak a few others. Before English, there was Polish and Yiddish and Ukrainian and German and Hebrew. Being an immigrant was certainly a formative experience. It just was something which permeated our life, and being an immigrant meant being an outsider and trying to belong, trying to understand. I have an idea that the reason many immigrants and were successful, for instance, at science in the United States but also elsewhere, and that goes as much for the Asian American immigrants today,
right,
as it was for the Jewish American immigrants of my time after World War II, they were outsiders as immigrants. Mm-hmm. So as an outsider, you stand outside, you don't quite understand all the conventions, all the little intangible, nonverbal, or partially verbal things that make people talk to each other. You can't express your humor or your humanity in a number of ways.
Because nobody will get you.
Nobody, you don't understand.
You don't understand them, but they don't get you.
They don't get you. And you try to understand. So you watch for signs. You're an observer, a watcher. Okay, that's a little bit about what scientists do. There is nature, and we can't get in and hold nature by the scruff of its neck and ask it for its secrets. You have to find out. You have to learn from clues. I think this is what really is part of what brought many immigrants into science. Mm-hmm. Plus, they came with no knowledge of the language, but because of the faults of the American educational system, they probably knew more mathematics than the kids in who were Americans.
Right.
And mathematics deals with symbols, with concepts, not necessarily with words as such.
Right.
And so mathematics, the natural language of science, was a way in for these kids.
Yes.
It was for me.
Yes, yes. So is that how you found a place to be?
I think I did. Though the words meant a lot to me, I still remember in sixth grade when I came in, the first class paper that I wrote according to some assignment. It was a small paragraph or two or perhaps a page on José San Martí. And this was very strange to me. I knew nothing about American colonial history, Spanish colonial history, but I wrote it in my best English that I could muster, and the teacher liked it.
Uh-huh.
So in there are two things. One is the words meant something to me. The other was I was eager to please.
Right.
So was everyone.
Right, right, right. And those words meant something to you, and that's even more significant in light of the English is the only language you write in now.
Yes. Those words meant something to me. That doesn't mean that the other things, the math, the chemical formulas mm-hmm. that shape my science, chemistry, they also mean a lot to me. But it was that trying to understand and communicating that seemed to matter a lot from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. I get this sense that you would be an observer in all likelihood, regardless of what you'd gone through.
Probably.
And but at the same time, that skill gets sharpened when you're an outsider.
Yes, that's what I that's what I see.
And and you've combined it with the desire to be liked, valued, appreciated, as we all do to some extent.
Yes.
And some of us are crusty in different ways, but we're.
But there may be something else. There may be something from back to the war
mm-hmm.
and survival. That we were in hiding in an attic, in a storeroom, in a schoolhouse the last year and a half of the war, hidden by a friendly Ukrainian schoolteacher's family. I think I must have questioned why we were hiding. Why were people out there wishing to kill us?
Right.
And it's this desire to understand, and also maybe if I could please them.
If you could understand them and then please them.
Them, but there was no pleasing the Nazis.
No.
So, because they were caught up in their own hate and virulence. And so, but I think the desire to please maybe goes back to that time.
And it sounds like at a much earlier age, but it sounds like a person's first kind of tragic love affair.
Yes. I was way before that. I was a child.
Yes, you were a child.
I was 7 years, 7.5 years when the war was over, and 11.5 when we came here to America.
Right, right. How has that need to be accepted, to be liked, shaped your life?
Well, after we came to America, we lived happily ever after. What I mean is things went well. And like many immigrants, we took advantage of the educational system and that being a way to advancement. I think this tendency to try to understand, to try to please, was behind my getting interested in many things. In college, taking advantage of a core curriculum, a general education.
Mm-hmm.
It really gives me such pleasure to try, to this day, to try to understand something or to try to learn something. Even in the last year, I've entered within my theoretical chemistry two fields which were entirely new to me. Subfields of chemistry to which we could apply our theory. And it's been such fun. And I thank someone, I thank myself for being able to retain the sense of wonder at the next molecule that I see coming up at a research group meeting. Or even as I was preparing the music that we're going to play,
mm-hmm.
And we're going to play next a Russian song. And let's play it, and then I'll tell you a little about it and what I learned about it.
Yes, and I'm gonna.
It's called "Na Sopkach Manchurskich" on Manchurian hills. So, what are the Russians doing, writing about Manchuria, which is a part of China now.
Yes.
And let's hear it.
Сопки покрыты мглой, вот из-за туч блеснула луна, могилы хранят покой, белеют кресты, это герои спят, прошлого тени кружатся вновь, о жертвах боев твердят. Плачет, плачет мать родная, плачет молодая жена. Плачут все, как один человек, свой рог и судьбу кляня. Тих вокруг ветер туман унес, на сопках маньчжурских воины спят, и русских не слышит слез. Пусть Гаолян нам навевает сны, спите, герои русской земли, отчизны родной сыны. Родная плачет молодая жена. Плачут все, как один человек, свой рог и судьбу кляня. Тихо вокруг ветер туман унес, на сопках маньчжурских воины спят, русских не слышат слез.
So, that is about as far away from Johann Strauss and the Blue Danube as you can get. It's the saddest waltz I've heard. Does one want to know the words? I understood them at first, and they are. It has to do with the Russian-Japanese War of 1905, in which the Russians were defeated in part. So that took place in Manchuria, and it talks about Russian graves and a young wife crying for her lost husband, and it ends up with some typical patriotic claptrap. But I love the music, and I like the feeling that it evoked. And I learned who it was written by. It was fun. There was Ilya Shatrov, who was a musician who lived into Soviet times. And I also learned, for whatever, whether it's true or not, this was Josef Stalin's favorite piece of music or waltz, and that doesn't detract from it.
Right.
I love the music.
But it is about dislocation on a whole bunch of levels.
Yes.
And damage.
And the damage that war does.
Right.
At many levels. And being buried in a foreign land, which is something Americans can appreciate with the wars that we have had recently.
Right.
And the fact that my father is buried somewhere, we don't know where, mm-hmm. after he was killed by the Nazis and their helpers in 1943. So that has certainly part of shaped my life. The Russian part was I knew Polish and I knew Ukrainian, but in 1960, in graduate school at Harvard, while trying to delay or avoid making a decision about whether I really wanted to be a chemist, mm-hmm. I didn't decide to be a chemist till 1 year away from my PhD in chemistry. So this is not a story of youthful enamorment. There's a more complicated mm-hmm, story. Mm-hmm. But I took off a year to go to the Soviet Union. I was not a communist. I went on a graduate student exchange. I was newly married for my wife and myself. This was our honeymoon. It was wonderful in a number of ways. My mother thought I'd be drafted into the Soviet Army because we were born in what was the Ukraine.
Right.
But there was no danger of that. Anyway, I learned Russian well, and it's a beautiful language, mm-hmm. and I've kept it to this day.
Wow. 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 And I mean, it's trite, but on a certain level, you take both the reality of the war and that sentimentalism on some level, but it's also beautiful. And you take the language and your mixed history of Soviet experience along with yes. Nazi experience, and you still
I have
something from it.
Yes, it was part of me. I'm very glad I went to the Soviet Union mm-hmm. at that time. Gave me a totally different picture of the world.
You practice, you write poetry and plays, and you still work as a scientist?
I do. I'm retired 6 years now, but I'm active in research. Fortunately, our system allows us that. No one takes away our labs. I do need funds for research, which we get from government agencies, applying. Mm-hmm. In the process of applying keeps me alive, yeah. As does the process of getting rejections on my poems when I submit them to journals.
Right, right.
I'm in the swing of the real world.
Right,
and
right.
It's not easy to get those research funds. Anyway, why do I need them? Because I need co-workers, mm-hmm. Not graduate students any longer, but now postdocs, and right now an undergraduate also, who is not supported, but for the postdocs I need to pay their salary.
Sure.
So I have a small research group together with Neil Ashcroft, a physicist in town, who also is retired, and we have a wonderful small research group. I'm very active in research still. Mm-hmm. In fact, I've had a revival in the last few years. I think in 2013 I published more scientific papers. That's our stock and trade,
right,
rather
right.
than books.
The gold standard of, yeah.
Oh, God, I've published 580 of them, and I love every one of them. Well, maybe not a few. But I published more, and I think did more interesting things in 2013 than I'd done for the last, I would say, 15 years at least.
Wow.
So that feels good at mm-hmm. my age.
Yes.
Which is 76.
What I'm wondering about is why do you keep working? Besides, I mean, it keeps you alive, but you can also write poetry and plays, and you get these things performed and published. I mean,
but
why do you keep working as a scientist?
I sometimes ask myself that. You know, I think I should have switched over to writing full-time some time ago. Why do I say should have? Because there are relatively fewer people who are scientists who write reflectively about science mm-hmm. for a general audience, which is what I'm interested in.
Right.
And in some way, even though the plays do have something to do with science, at least two of the three I've written, mm-hmm. the third one doesn't. It's an autobiographical one. The poems do and do not have. Anyway, I think I would be of some way more value to the world if I switched over. On the other hand, the science just continues to be such great fun, and I can't seem to turn it off.
Right.
As I told you, I look in a journal, and I see these in every issue of a leading journal. There are 30, 40 articles. Mm-hmm. I look in them. They're not all interesting, and I don't understand half of them. But in 10 of them, I see people making molecules that I could ask a question about, and that I also imagine that they want to know something in the nature of a why question. Mm-hmm. Why does this molecule bend at this certain atom? Why does it react in a certain way with an acid or a base? And I think I can try to answer that.
Mm-hmm.
But finding that molecule, I also find in that same journal someone who has done what I had meant to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I feel envious in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's okay. I'll get over that. There are so many things that we want to do.
It sounds like you see envious, but also perhaps challenged.
Yes.
And you like to play.
I like to play. So the other thing is the world of molecules gives me a semi-infinite playground. Chemists have made, it's estimated around 70 million new molecules to add to the many that nature has.
Mm-hmm.
And there, each one presents a certain problem. So this also matches my part of the same philosophy that I think underlies some of my interest in the poetry.
Mm-hmm.
That is, that I'm interested in the individual, and I see the universal through the individual. The individual is that molecule.
Right.
The reason that's connected to poetry is when Archie Ammons wrote a poem about looking at a blade of grass with a drop of dew on it. It was that particular blade of grass, mm-hmm. and no other. It wasn't all blades of grass, right. and the biochemistries and all of them. It was that blade of grass and that drop of dew which made him think about what it means to look at a blade of grass.
Or when he looked at the reeds and he saw the reeds give way to the wind and give the wind away.
Yes, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And it's the universal through the particular. And you know, I found in chemistry something similar. There is that molecule, and I work on that molecule. While I'm working on it, I see, while I'm doing calculations on a computer and where the electrons are in that molecule, which is what I do, I work with computers, or my students do. When I see that, I keep in mind all the connections of that molecule to the 70 million other molecules. Mm-hmm. And that gives great satisfaction when I can see a connection between two molecules in a very different part of the chemical universe.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something that pulls them together. It's in my mind that they're pulled together. And when I can share it with someone else by writing that article,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I love it.
And someone who, again, is looking at the journal, understanding 10 of the articles and having this.
Yes.
I mean, it's a community that you find.
I have a community. It's interesting that community is remote. It's not here in front of me. But in teaching, which I miss now,
mm-hmm.
the 6 years that I haven't been teaching, though I give lectures, which is a way of teaching. In that I'm trying to explain something. There is 300 faces in front of me. One quarter of them haven't gotten enough sleep. Among them are people who understand. Among them are people who don't understand anything. And I have to speak to all of them mm-hmm. at the same time. I love it.
Yep.
And the same way, when I write a scientific paper about the property of that molecule, it used to be that it would get printed in a journal and 1,000 copies would be sent to libraries worldwide. Now it's on a web electronically.
Mm-hmm.
Still out there are 1,000 remote readers.
Right.
I can't grab them by the scruff of their neck and say, this is what I meant and this is not not what you think I meant.
Right.
It has to be all there in my words and drawings.
Mm-hmm.
it's a teaching action also, this research.
Right, and it's a discipline that you hold yourself to.
Yes.
Right.
Well, I think it's more fun than discipline.
Well, I don't use discipline as a punishing sort of thing. If I want to sing, I need to know how it works.
Yeah.
If I want to write, I need to know how it works and to play with it. That's the sense of discipline. Yeah.
Actually, that's a good lead into the next piece of music,
which
is a Haydn trio.
Okay, so do you want to say more about it?
I will say something afterwards. Okay. Let's listen to it. But it's play.
WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Roald Hoffman.
And what you heard was a Haydn piano trio played by the Beaux-Arts trio, and I think it is playful, and yet it is discipline. Music, I love these things, the Haydn piano trios. There are 8 CDs full of them, they're just as beautiful as this.
Yes, yes, yes. So one of the things that I have wondered, because I know that, you went through great tragedy and suffering very young and great accomplishment relatively early.
Yes.
In what ways was winning the Nobel Prize a distraction, and in what ways was it a benefit?
Yes, people have romantic notions about Nobel Prizes. Let's not talk about whether they're given justly or not. I will talk about the personal thing. The only people or institutions in this world for whom my Nobel Prize was an unqualified plus was my mother and family and my university for different reasons. And they're both obvious to anyone.
And obviously unqualified plus.
An unqualified plus. But for me myself, it's actually a mix.
Mm-hmm.
In part, it created certain barriers between me and students, and I was teaching, and I was interested in reaching them. They put me on a pedestal.
And you were teaching introductory chemistry at that point.
I was. Half the time. In my 43 years of teaching, I taught introductory chemistry. It's okay. It's America. Our students are not too respectful. If there's a final tomorrow and they see me in a library, when we used to have a library, and it wasn't replaced by an electronic resource, they would approach me anyway. It also gave me opportunities to make a fool of myself if I were stupid enough to have weird notions about race and intelligence. Then the press, it would be sure to ask me for those things.
Right.
At the same time, it gave me an opportunity to do some good, perhaps by signing some petitions or in some causes. It didn't make it any easier for me to get research money. Now, this is really hard for somebody to understand. But the reason is that the research grants and the papers are right are reviewed anonymously. Mm-hmm. And in the dark, when you think that nobody can see you, we know what happens. Mm-hmm. Envy and jealousy come out, and right. there are enough people out there who maybe didn't like me that enough to sometimes sink some proposals. And actually, at one point, I lost my support, mm-hmm. but I regained it, and I'm proud of that. So the pluses and minuses overall. Right. But I also had a great benefit of having a supportive family, a wife and children, mm-hmm. and they helped me through these difficult times at times.
Mm-hmm. What life threw you at the beginning was something way out of your control, but winning this prize was something you won, and dealing with the aftermath is kind of a process of growing up that in some sense you didn't have the luxury of the first time around.
Yes, I survived the Nobel Prize too.
Yeah,
it's hard to imagine someone talking about that too, but one of the things that I needed to survive was that, you know, I went along doing in chemistry the next thing that I wanted to do that I thought was interesting and exciting, and society allowed me to do that. And now comes the Nobel Prize, and people start asking you, what are you going to do next? And it's not just me. It's Toni Morrison's next novel.
Right, right.
And people begin to examine that. And, you know, if you don't ask yourself, what are you going to do next? If enough other people ask you, you begin to ask that question. And I'm not sure it's a great question to ask, because you want to follow your instincts.
Right.
And
I'll tell you when I know.
Yes.
I'll tell you when I know.
Yes.
And it's hard to have the composure or the spine to stand up to people pounding on your door asking for answers.
That's right. Yeah. Let's play another piece of music.
Yes. And
I'll tell you afterwards.
Okie doke. Here we go. And this is...
this is... So that was a piece of music called Visa från Utanmyra by Jan Johansson, a Swedish jazz pianist. And this was recorded in the 60s. He died, unfortunately, very young, 1968, I believe. And it's part of my Swedish connection, which comes through my wife, Eva, who has been a part of my life for a very long time. We were married just before we went to Russia when we were both very young. I love the wistful sound and the melody. As you can see, I'm a sucker for melodies.
And I can just, I can almost feel what I would imagine as the models of molecules kind of dancing around the little notes on the keyboard as he's playing those riffs.
Music is very important to me. I listen to it. I don't play anything. I'm fortunate that I'm open to all kinds of music. I'm not saying this bragging. It just happens to be that almost that anything live goes for me. And yeah, these are not live, but actually I want to play another piece of music, which is very different from this.
And shall we play it now?
Yes, play it. Okay. Different culture. And so there is something about cultures here.
Rayando la aurora, me voy pa' meter al son de la luna, me voy pa'
Our guest in this hour is Roald Hoffman, and that was La Canoa Rancha.
Yes, that's about as far away from Southeast Poland as you can get. It's a Colombian cumbia.
And how did you come to know cumbia music? Cumbia.
So I got to know Colombia in a funny way, way before I was there, because my mother at one point moved to Jackson Heights in Queens, which is little Colombia. We moved there, the neighborhood was just being populated by Colombians, and I could hear in the bars around, streaming loudly from them, the music of vallenatos and cumbias. So that's where I first heard it.
Wow.
And from some friends there. I was in college then. I didn't go to Colombia till much later, only till about 5 years ago, and I've been there twice and enjoyed it. So this is a Grupo Niche, which is a group centered in Cali that apparently has been going for 35 years. I've been listening to them for much less. And this is based on folk sources. The lines are more or less nonsensical about it. It's about a moldy canoe.
Right.
But at one point they says, someone says, there's a chorus, as you can hear in this. Someone says, what are those buns for? Meaning buns to eat. And someone says, they're to eat with my coffee. And I just love that.
Yeah. Just a random comment.
The music, the words are crazy.
Yeah.
But it's great fun. It's great music to dance to. I love Latin music.
So in our last 10 minutes here, I'd like to turn a little bit to what have you learned, and how have you learned to take care of yourself? And also a little bit, what do you do to, but more importantly, how have you learned that you need to?
Well, taking care of myself has been difficult to learn.
Yeah.
The science is both demanding and addictive. And I have filled every day with things that I need to do and that I want to do on both. And the line between the two is not clear.
Right.
But somehow one has to make room for these other things. So I think that my interest in writing and also in different cultures and in music, I think these have helped me to keep a spiritual balance somehow. These are other passions. And I think everyone needs some sort of spiritual passions other than one's profession. Though my profession is so much fun, as I've
gotten across.
But they've helped me.
And what do you mean by spiritual passion?
So I think, first of all, even though I am not religious in a formal sense of the word, I believe in spiritual things. So I think that these spiritual actions are in part contemplation, in part action, but they are things which take you in some way, even though they're done often in a solitary mode, though sometimes together, they take you outside yourself to some shared ground with other people.
Mm-hmm.
To me, going outside of a house on a cold winter night and seeing the stars, perhaps hoping to see the aurora. But looking at those stars, I can see them as a scientist, but there is much more. It's not only there are many other people standing outside their houses looking at those same stars, and the shared wonder of that world does not lead me, as it does the psalmist, to the creator, but it leads me to something I share with other human beings, which is other than myself. I think music is wonderful for that. also. It's something that's shared. I can't think of a more spiritual activity than dancing with one's friends.
Right, right. And one of the, and I think it's correct that and shrewd that you use the term spiritual to describe that, because spirituality tends to, people who describe themselves as spiritual tend to emphasize the connections they have,
yes,
with the world around them and the other people around them, rather than kind of superstructure of understanding like religion might enforce by way of theology or ritual. But you also have described yourself as a ritual junkie.
Yeah,
and is that like the dance or what?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I've sometimes, we've had a conversation on this previously about religion and atheism, and I'm an unusual atheist who has, I think I am, that I have some understanding of how religious people think. And I think certainly so within my tradition, mm-hmm. within the Jewish tradition. But I feel ritual. So that's what you meant by ritual junking. And I feel it again often through music or words or a sense of time and place. But when I go into a church and I hear a mass sung, I feel something. Now, my friends who are religious, who've tried to sometimes draw me back to religious Judaism, they haven't tried too hard, would perhaps make use of that ritual. And the song we played at the beginning,
yes,
welcoming
ritual,
the Sabbath,
yes,
is part of that warm ritual that accompanies the Sabbath. Mm-hmm. And the Sabbath is a wonderful concept, a great invention of the Jews.
And that restoration piece of taking time to step out of,
yes,
yourself and put it back together again.
Oh, I wish I could learn that better, how that piece, how to reach that piece. But the friends who are Jewish would sometimes say, well, maybe we can get you back to ritual. The problem is that I sense that feeling as much as I... as when I go into a Hasidic synagogue in Jerusalem, I feel something, but I also feel it in an Afro-Brazilian possession rite that I witness on a beach in Rio de Janeiro, or I feel it in dancing to Bob Marley, the Wailers. It's something I share with other people, and it's more than me.
Right, and it's not owned by any one tradition.
No.
And I think that is more the key piece than is that you feel it and you know that nobody has sole possession of it.
Yes. How do I help myself in other ways? It's not easy sometimes. I had a bout of depression and I had to deal with that, both through talking to people and through medical help at some point. There are ways, I think, other people can help you get through yourself. But let me tell you something which I do, which you can see the music is important to me.
Yes.
And there is, I would like actually to perhaps play a piece of music that I have sometimes used to help myself. Oh, there are many pieces of music that I do. But this is a piece from a Bach cello sonata, and it's played by Mstislav Rostropovich. So there is the Russian link. My first recording of these that I ever had was by Pablo Casals, a very different recording. But this is a piece of music I like.
And this is where you go.
Yes. Thank you. So you've listened to Mstislav Rostropovich playing a movement from, I believe, the number 5 unaccompanied sonata for cello by Bach. A wonderful piece of music.
Hmm. When you go there to listen to that music, what is it that you experience?
Well, I am outside of myself somehow. I am with the music. I forget what instrument it's being played for, though I like that it is just one instrument. And I feel that this is somehow leading me from a lack of joy, from suffering to something which is makes the world bearable and even happy.
Roald, it's been good to get to know you a bit. Thank you for joining me this morning, joining us.
Thank you,
Eric. And you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca.